This is Tax Update for Saturday, January the 21st, 2006. Tax Update is podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is being sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. They offer email newsletters on matters of interest to tax professionals, as well as resources for tax professionals for information of interest to those professionals. It is available by subscription. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This week, since the Schedule D situation seems to have calmed down, we'll mainly deal with an actually unrelated topic. This week's topic is simplified employee pension plans, an option that's available for taxpayers who failed to do their tax planning before the end of last year and who come to you now and ask what can be done. Quick update on the Schedule D situation. As noted last week, the IRS now has officially announced the acceptance of attachments to the 8453. The IRS has posted that to the website as a headliner in the Small Business and Self-Employed section. So, essentially, it appears we have a resolution in that area at this point moving forward. If anything further develops, we'll try and update you on a future podcast, but for now it appears the Schedule D problem has been laid to rest and we can move on to another topic. A simplified employee pension is offered as a retirement plan that was meant to be simpler for employers to implement than the traditional plans that we find under the standard qualified plan rules that have the separate trust and all the accounting and the reporting. The SEP was meant to be a simple, easy-to-use plan. One unique feature of a SEP compared to a standard qualified plan is that the SEP plan itself did not have to be in existence as of the end of the year in question when we're going to take our deduction. So a taxpayer who would be eligible to establish a simplified employee pension plan for his or her business could still do so for 2005 at this point, even though that same taxpayer could not at this point establish a profit-sharing plan or a defined benefit pension plan for that enterprise. As such, the SEP may be the one retirement plan available. The downside of SEPs is they're not terribly flexible. There's limited flexibility in designing the plan, limited flexibility in who can be excluded or covered. But in some cases, we may find that a SEP plan is the perfect fit for a client because we don't need those other options to be available, and it certainly is a tool that everyone should consider. As a practical matter, I normally always start with the SEP when I take a look at a qualified plan issue for a client, saying, well, what would happen if we did a SEP, and then how do I improve on that by taking a look at other plan options? So it's important to understand exactly how the SEP would work because there are advantages to it. As well, a SEP poses risks for tax professionals who do not normally deal in the qualified plan area. The problem with a SEP is that, unlike other qualified plans, this is sold as essentially needing no professional assistance from a plan administrator to work with. Well, that may be good news initially as far as the client is concerned, because to the client that means they won't have to pay for an additional professional to be involved and handle plan administration tasks. Instead, they can just sit back and handle this plan without having to file the reports or pay for a third-party administrator. The problem is the tax professional, the tax preparer, or the attorney who's working with the client on general tax matters maybe the person who by default ends up being the compliance person to watch over this plan, or at least the person the client will assume is watching over their compliance issues with what needs to be done, who needs to be covered, etc. You as the advisor may be the only person, arguably with the expertise, to have understood what the client needs to have done or shouldn't have done with the plan, and if something goes wrong, you may be the person the client looks to hold responsible for the problems. So it is important to have a basic understanding of SEPs, largely because you may be the only person involved who reasonably could understand how this is supposed to work and where the traps exist. A SEP contribution, we'll start and talk about a few code sections that are of importance here and that are in your materials. Let's talk about the basic rules for a SEP. The basic rules defining out a SEP start in section 408K. Section 408 is the general section dealing with individual retirement accounts. 408K is a subsection of that that tells us how a simplified employee pension works. And basically, 408K1 tells us that for purposes of Title 26, Internal Revenue Code, a simplified employee pension means a retirement account that meets four requirements listed in this section. And if the part of a top-heavy plan, it has to meet the requirements of Section 416. Now, the four requirements are the participation requirements, the non-discrimination of contribution requirements, the requirements that restrict us from not allowing our participants to withdraw the funds, and the fact that there must be a written allocation formula. Let's go through those four particular requirements. First, and probably the best known area, is in the participation requirements. A simplified employee pension plan, at a minimum, must cover all employees who meet the following three criteria. We can be more generous than these criteria, but we cannot be less generous than these criteria. Every employee who has reached age 21, who has performed service for the employer during at least three of the immediately preceding 5 years, and who has received at least $450 in compensation from the employer for the year. Now, basically, those are your three tests. Note, the compensation limit is very, very low compared to a qualified plan where we are allowed to exclude people who work under certain much larger number of hours during the year than you would need to work to get $450 even at minimum wage. For the SEP, we have to start picking up people at $450, age 21, that's relatively standard. And the vesting issue is that we run into is we have to fund the plan if they have worked for us for three of the immediately preceding 5 years. That vesting is a bit longer than we normally see in a qualified plan, or I shouldn't say vesting, but the coverage requirements is one that we would see in most top-heavy plans, and the plans that we usually would worry about a SEP for would almost automatically go top-heavy. But the other two are generally, the other one, the age one, is not really any better than we get under a qualified plan. And the compensation requires us to cover people who are paid much less than they would be or who work many fewer hours than they would to be covered by most qualified plans. Key caveat, under the terms of the SEP, we run into an issue here quite often with the years of service problem. Why? Our issue becomes that the owner of the entity, let's say who just started XYZ Corporation last year and went into business, decides to set up a SEP. We have the owner, and we have three employees who started up on that same day. The owner decides that he should be able to get a SEP contribution, because obviously he's the owner and it's a SEP, but he can exclude his employees, he believes, because they haven't met the 3 of 5. The problem is, neither has he. And so if his SEP plan requires 3 years of service, he doesn't meet it, and nobody gets a contribution. If he sets the years of service low enough to cover himself, then he's going to have to bring in the employees. That presents a problem. Now, I use the example here of a corporation where we see this more often, especially due to misunderstandings by many preparers, is when we have a Schedule C self-employed individual. Many preparers seem to be under the mistaken thought that you can put a SEP in, or a SEP is somehow linked solely to self-employment income, and that somehow we can ignore the employees, or the 3 of 5 doesn't count, we can add this one person in. That is a key operational problem with a SEP. 408K3 tells us we cannot discriminate in favor of the highly compensated employees. That's a pretty standard rule that we find in most plans. Note that basically what we come down to with K3 is that the contributions must bear a uniform relationship to total compensation. Therefore, the general rule for a SEP, and the rule that will be the rule if you adopt the IRS standard SEP document, is that we basically have to allocate our total contribution among those who are eligible based upon their total covered compensation. So we don't get any fancy allocations or things that are similar to what we may find in a new comparability plan under the qualified plan rules. Rather, we're going to do a straight allocation. We are allowed to use permitted disparity, 408K3D, or what was better known in shorthand by its old name, Social Security Integration. However, your SEP plan has to provide for that. The standard IRS plan does not, so you're going to have to obtain your SEP document from a third party. Oh yeah, there's that issue, a SEP document. Note, as we'll find later, we are going to need a written allocation formula. You do need a SEP plan. So hopefully your clients can find that plan, because if you're going to compute the contribution and make it, you're going to have to know what the plan says, so it'd be very nice to find the document. 408K4 tells us that withdrawals must be permitted. Basically, you can't enter into an agreement to fund a SEP account with an IRA custodian for the employee, which will not allow the employee to turn around the next day and take the money out. For some employers, the fact that employees can do this is a major negative, because they think the employees are mismanaging the money and they're concerned about that. Other employers, and frankly the majority of my clients in this area, have traditionally indicated that this was the employee's problem, and if they want to take the money out, that's fine. But basically, you cannot restrict the employees in any way from taking that money back out. If they do, they will be subject to tax, and they will be subject to premature distribution penalties if they're under age 59.5 when they do this. But you cannot impose as a condition under your SEP plan that the funds must remain in the plan. 408K5, our final requirement to have a SEP plan, is the contribution must be made under a written allocation formula. And this tells us that if the employer contribution such plan determined under a definite written allocation formula, so better find the written plan, which specifies the requirements which an employee must satisfy to share in an allocation. There's our problem of letting the owner in after 1 year and the employees in after 3. Doesn't quite work. And the manner in which such amount allocated is computed, remembering our restriction above that we pretty much have to do it based upon earnings, with only permitted disparity allowed to make the differential. Now, if you follow 408K on, we now find K6, which is the old SARSEP rules. Note, these rules essentially are in the code only for old plans that were already in place when we had the simples added to the code. For that reason, most of 408K6 will not be of interest to you unless you had a plan in place that was a SARSEP before December 31st, 1996. If the plan did not exist on that date, the SARSEP wasn't there, you don't have to worry about this particular section. Then you talk about simples. Those are another variant that replaced the SARSEP. Big hitch with the simple compared to the SEP is that the simple you cannot establish after the end of the year for the employer. In essence, due to the notice requirements, we have a much earlier deadline to get a simple in place. We're not going to have a shot to put it in place. In fact, a simple needs to be in place earlier than a standard qualified plan, which could actually have been established as late as December 31st of last year. Now, 408K7 tells us some of the definitions. We get some interesting definitional tools in here. Note, key one there, 408K7A tells us that an employee and owner-employee have the same meanings as 401C. That means we get to treat the self-employed person as if they were an employee. Note, mechanically, that's what's important here. We treat them as if they were an employee. Watch out for the confusion that somehow a SEP is only involves the self-employed and we could ignore everyone else. We can't ignore them. We do have to worry about what those do. Now, Section 408L tells us about our simplified reports. 408L1 tells us essentially we don't really need to make much in the way of reports. In fact, the custodian for the IRA is the primary reporting entity that we deal with. Now, under Section 402, we talk about the tax status of the beneficiary, that is the employee. And of course, if you're the owner, you probably got an allocation, so you're somewhat interested in this taxation as well. Section 402H tells us the special rules for a simplified employee pension. And it tells us that in general, unless we exceed our limitations, we're not going to pay tax on the amount contributed to the plan. That's under Section 402H1. Now, Section 402H2 contains the limitations on employer contributions. And this tells us contributions by an employer to a simplified employee pension with respect for an employee for any year shall be treated as distributed or made available to the such employee, and as contributions made by the employee cent of such contributions exceed the lesser of 25% of the contribution for such employer includable in the employee's gross income for the year, or the limitation in effect under Section 415. So this is where we find the 25% limitation on the contributions for the plan, as well realize that we have the overall cap limitation on defined contribution plans are applicable to allocations to simplified employee pensions. Under Section 402H3, it tells us if we take money out of here, it's going to be taxed in the same manner as if it had come from contributions to an individual retirement account. So basically, we look under Section 408D for our distributions. Sections 404 tells us the deduction rules. This is nice because as an employer, we'd like to get a deduction for the contributions to the simplified employee pension. And under 404H1 tells us the basic deduction. Contributions are for a year deductible in the case of a simplified employee pension maintained on a calendar year for the taxable year with or within which the calendar year ends. So that allows us to take a deduction for this. Now we're going to have a reference going back into here as to why this works. Contributions shall be treated for purposes of a section if they are made for a taxable year. If such contributions are made on account of such taxable year, so we have a contribution for 2005, and is made not later than the time prescribed by law for filing such tax return for the taxable year, including extensions. Now that's important because generally we can't put money in an IRA for 2005 after April 15th. But if we have a SEP contribution, that could go in as late as the extended due date of the employer sponsor's tax return. Therefore, if we have an extension on a Schedule C, basically an individual return 1040 who is the sponsor, and that extension this year would automatically be 6 months under the revised rules dealing with extensions that we will have this year, we would basically have until October 15th to fund up the SEP, still get the deduction, still be allowed to exclude it from the employee's income as contribution. So basically, we have that particular set of rules in play. Now, what are some of the problems? Because we've talked about them. The big problem, as noted, is that we're not required to have anybody involved to administer the SEP. That's good news, but it doesn't mean the plan doesn't need to be administered and handled properly. It just means there will not most likely be a third-party administrator who's looking over somebody's shoulder and taking care of the proper administration of this trust account. Rather, it's far more likely that we are going to find that we have the individual who's running the plan or the owner, maybe the person in charge, and that person is probably going to rely on the tax professionals to make the actual computation and make sure the allocations get done. That's a key issue. Second key problem with SEPs, you cannot pick and choose who to fund for. There is no provision in a SEP to require that an individual be an employee on the last day of the taxable year. that can present some real problems because many cases employers do not want to fund for an account for some employee who may have left or quit in June. The employer may also have trouble just contacting that employee if they left early in the year in order to enable them to make the contribution. While rules exist to allow an employer to establish an IRA on behalf of such of an individual, this is a complication that many employers find distasteful. You may have to make sure your client can live with the concept of having to fund a contribution for somebody who leaves during the year, no matter what, if they are going to accept having a SEP. Otherwise, you may find yourself with a very, very nasty surprise come April 15th when they're getting ready to file the return and they're going to tell you they're not going to make a contribution for John over here. As well, they cannot pick and choose in favor of employees. Sometimes we have seen clients who hired somebody that they wanted to now include in the plan immediately. Again, the SEP has to be operated in accordance with its written allocation formula, and the allocation formula says that individual doesn't get an allocation. And if we change the years of service, we have to change it for everybody. So there is a very real problem of getting it funded up. Next big problem. In many cases, clients do not have or cannot find or never executed the written SEP document. The client is required to have that written allocation formula. Remember the rule that we talked about. A client without the written allocation formula arguably doesn't have a SEP, arguably gets no deduction, and the amounts that were contributed very quickly become excess contributions to the IRA account of the employee, includable in income, and subject to the excise tax, so it's not a good result. It is important that employers keep that up. As well, like qualified plans, from time to time Congress changes the rules. From time to time, you have to update your SEP to make sure you're working on the current document. If a taxpayer signed off on the 5805 SEP IRS form, make sure that the taxpayer executes the more recent ones whenever the IRS updates that form. You wish to be operating under the most recent form. As well, make sure the client knows where that form is and make sure the client keeps that form available, especially if an examination begins. It'll be important to be able to bring out the document. It will also be important to show that you told the employees about what's going on and that all contributions were timely made to the IRA accounts in question. Other big problems that we can run into include employers who wish to manage their account or do other problems. You may pick up an account that's had trouble for years and how you fix it is not clear. It's also very likely to run into problems for the simple reason that the IRS has not been incredibly aggressive in examining SEP plans. In fact, recent studies that were taken indicated that SEP plans have a high level of noncompliance. The hitch is, because no reports are filed, essentially nobody's minding the store. That can create problems. It can create problems even if the IRS never steps up their enforcement. Why? Because the employee may still file a complaint or file with the Department of Labor for the mismanagement of this fund or for the misuse of this fund, not providing the expected benefit or not providing the allocation the way it should be done. That can create complications for the employer sponsor as well. For all of these reasons, it's important that your clients understand the rules and the restrictions and that you understand how it should be worked with, or at least find out that the client is getting proper advice from somebody to manage that plan. Finally, let's consider when a SEP makes sense. As compared to other types of plans, a SEP makes lots of sense if we have one owner employee, one person, nobody else in the business. We are earning substantial sums of money so that we can get over the limitations, the maximum 415 limitations for that person. And we wish to stash the money away in a way not having to spend the excess money to set up a plan, perhaps also in a case where the person involved is not over age 50, so we're not going to be able to make use of a catch-up contribution if we put a 401k feature onto the plan. In that case, a SEP may make a lot more sense because a qualified plan is not going to buy us anything in terms of funding. It will not give us any significant advantage from a tax standpoint over the traditional qualified plans and will eliminate many of the funding problems and many of the problems involved with just keeping the I's dotted and T's crossed for a qualified plan. As well, with only one participant and nobody else providing services, many of the potential problems or many of the potential issues that arise in operating a SEP don't show up in this case. A SEP may not work as well, though, if the individual's earnings are not high enough where the 25% of compensation calculation will kick us over the 415 limits. In that case, a more significant contribution may be able to be made by using a solo 401k or any type of 401k if we have to cover other people. Safe Harbor 401ks may work in that case just as well or better. That may be especially true if the individual in question is over age 50 and will qualify for the catch-up contributions. In that case, you may need to consider the 401k as an alternative. Again, if we're talking about 2005, remember, that's not available if the plan was not already in place. So if we're talking now about doing something for 2005, that's not an issue, but it may be something to look forward to for 2006. It may also not be the best plan if you have somebody making, again, significant money, but is an older individual with a relatively steady source of income. In that case, a defined benefit plan may allow them to put back more money, do more saving for retirement, if they are comfortable with the issues that arise when we do a defined benefit plan. For those not aware of what a defined benefit plan is, that's essentially the old style, shall we call it, pension plan, where the plan agrees to provide a benefit of X dollars to the retiree on the retirement date for life. In that structure, the amount of contribution is tagged based upon how much is needed to fund actuarially the value of the benefit that is being promised. That may be significantly greater than what you'd be allowed with the limitation under the defined contribution plans. The limitation in a defined benefit plan is not on the contribution directly. The limitation instead arises from the benefit that can be paid on the back end. Now, caveat, be very, very careful here if you talk with somebody about a 412i plan. There's nothing inherently wrong with those plans. They are funded by insurance policies, rather than the alternative for your defined benefit plan is to fund it via a trust. But the hitch with 412i's, there were some aggressive 412i's being pushed where the insurance policy in question created a much larger benefit than the plan would technically allow, and through various machinations, we could get that policy supposedly out at a low tax cost somewhere down the line. Those plans are now on the listed transaction list and cause us some major problems. Key caveat, if you're not used to dealing with plans, there will be a determination letter even on those plans where someone, a promoter, may tell you the IRS has blessed the plan. They have blessed the plan. They have not blessed the insurance policies that will be used to fund the plan, and that's where the problem would arise with defined contribution. But again, a defined contribution plan may make sense even for that single owner. If you have additional employees, a SEP may make sense if most of your employees don't stay around more than a year or two. In which case, the 3 of 5 rule will wipe out most funding. It may not be so great if you have a lot of part-time employees who will have to be covered under the SEP because they're going to clear the 450, but who do stay around long enough to get in. So long-term part-time employees may shift you away from the SEP. As well, because the SEP has very limited methods of skewing the allocations to somebody, and generally the skewing would be hopefully to the highly compensated owner, is our theory. Because there are very few ability to do that, very limited ability to do that in a SEP may not make sense if you have a lot of employees. You may need to look at other options and other plans to make use of for a SEP. But a SEP is still a very useful tool. We have found it useful in a number of cases where, when we ran the numbers, it made little sense to incur the additional expense to get something fancier when the SEP got us where we needed to go, or the extra cost, let's say, for employee funding on the SEP was so low that there was no way we were going to end up paying more for employee funding than we were going to end up paying to run the full-blown qualified plan. So it is a nice thing to run your numbers on and take a look at. This podcast has been sponsored by Limeburg Services. Limeburg Information Services provides email newsletters to tax professionals. You can find out about them at www.limebergservices.com. This has been Tax Update for Saturday, January the 21st, 2006.